I learned a lot from Anwar Sadat at Camp David, who pointed out to me and Begin repeatedly that we all look upon the same God as divine and as the shaper of our lives, our priorities, and our moral values. In that way, I learned to kind of seek the common ground among people who are at odds and emphasize that rather than to emphasize the differences. And once you find out what the common ground is, quite often it's very great. When the most powerful nation on earth and the incumbent of the White House says that a cornerstone of America's foreign policy will be the protection of human rights, there is a direct effect, and I think a permanent effect derived from that.
Former President Jimmy Carter on this edition of Common Ground.
One thing that you have to remember about the Carter Center is that we're not intimidated. We don't have anything to lose by being aggressive or open. We're very tenacious. We stick with things. We'll be very patient. And we try to be students and listeners more than we are teachers and preachers.
Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Since leaving the White House, Jimmy Carter has been involved in peace efforts around the world. Lately, he and his team at the Carter Center in Atlanta have tried to bring some relief, including a ceasefire followed by serious medical attention, to the war in Sudan, one of the most brutal, deadly, and largely unknown conflicts ever waged.
Well, we became interested in Sudan almost 10 years ago. And in 1989, we had extensive peace talks in Nairobi with the leaders of Sudan government and the rebel organizations in the south. Those peace talks by us and others have not been fruitful. For 12 years now, Sudan has been involved in an often vicious and very destructive war. More than 1 million people have died in Sudan. And although we have very successful programs in immunizing children and eradicating guinea worm and in preventing river blindness in other nations, primarily in Africa, we've not been able to get into the southern part of Sudan. This past March, we went back to Sudan for maybe the 10th time and induced the rebel groups and the government to have a ceasefire that started the 28th of March, I think. And the ceasefire is still going on. And during that interval period, now approaching 6 months, we've been able to go into the south to visit villages that had never been visited, to identify guinea worm cases that we had never known about, to distribute tablets that prevent river blindness, and to immunize children. It's been a very successful program. And as I say, it's still progressing. The problem is that all of this is one of the worst wars in history, certainly in recent history. And the devastation has been indescribable, and the number of refugees and displaced persons is very high. The Western world has practically no knowledge of Sudan. They are not white people. They don't have oil to sell. We have no strategic interest there as far as benefiting our own nation with involvement or even Europe. And this is a tragedy. What folks don't realize is that Sudan could be the breadbasket of of Africa if it was cultivated right. And also, the size of Sudan is equal to the entire United States east of Mississippi. And so we've immersed ourselves pretty deeply in Sudan, and I think now both sides, the Southerners and the government itself, have an adequate degree of trust in us that our role there is to benefit the people of Sudan.
You say the ceasefire is still continuing.
Yes.
I know there have been violations reported. What have you done to respond to those ceasefire violations?
Well, the violations in recent weeks have been almost entirely with rebel groups fighting each other. They've not involved the government versus the southern rebels, non-Muslims. So there's nothing we can do to stop that violence except publicly to condemn the violence when it does occur. And obviously this condemnation is shared by the U.S. government and by U.N. spokesmen and the news media as well. So it puts a great deal of onus or responsibility on a group that's responsible for violation of the ceasefire. It's a bad image for them. And of course, all the participants in any conflict in the world want their global image to be favorable. They want people to have confidence in them, to make investments there, to have jobs there, to have tourists come perhaps, and, or in the case of a war like in Sudan, to give financial or maybe military aid to a trustworthy group.
One Sudanese exile, Bonham Awal, who's based in London, he publishes Sudan Democratic Gazette.
Yes, I know him well.
He said that you're trying to rehabilitate the image of the regime led by General al-Bashir. How do you respond to that?
Well, we go into a country that's at war and try to alleviate the level of violence and death and human rights violations. And in doing so, you've got to be able at least to converse with both sides. You can't just talk to one side and expect the other to cooperate. In fact, it alienates them and makes them less willing to cooperate. So a lot of our work at the Carter Center is done with people who are not popular in this country and maybe certainly not popular with exiles if you look toward a ruling party. I know Bonham Awal very well. He's one of the first Sudanese I ever met. He's living in exile because he's incompatible with the ruling government. And I never do speak in defense of the policies of the ruling government. But if you look back at what we've done the last year or so, there was a threatened building up of a nuclear arsenal in North Korea. The only person that could resolve that crisis was Kim Il-sung. But no one in our government was permitted to talk to Kim Il-sung, so we went and talked to him, and he basically agreed with everything that our government needed. The same thing happened in Haiti when we were poised for a war with 30,000 troops offshore. Some of the airplanes had already taken off with paratroopers and other things because our government would not speak to or even communicate in any way with the people in Haiti who could resolve the conflict. So we went there and resolved the conflict. This past December, we did the same thing with the Bosnian Serbs. No one in our government has been willing to talk to the Bosnian Serbs to go to Pali. We talked to both sides. But in every case, when there's a conflict, our purpose is to go there and reduce the level of violence and death and human rights suffering, even by those who may have caused it in the first place, because they are the ones that have to change their policy.
One more question on Sudan. How do you characterize the medical process there, the eradication of guinea worm and the other health goals that you have? How successful have you been?
Well, I think it's been gloriously successful. By the time we finish there, we'll know every village that has guinea worm, and we'll almost know every person that has guinea worm. We will have distributed 50,000 or more tablets that would prevent river blindness. And 6 months ago, they had never had any tablets distributed of amectazine that would prevent river blindness. We've immunized tens of thousands of children who in the past have never been immunized against measles or polio or diphtheria and so forth. So I would say quite successful. And the reason for this is that both the rebel leaders in the south who are non-Muslims and the Muslim government in Khartoum both know the great need for this humanitarian effort. And I think that it's been very successful. Another extremely successful program that we've already completed in Sudan, we could only get to the northern region, but it was approved by the leaders of the Southern People's Liberation Army, John Garang, was to increase the production of wheat in Sudan. We went in for a five-year period. They were only producing 160,000 tons of wheat per year. We increased their production to about 1 million tons per year in just 5 years. And then we left Sudan, which we try to limit our effort to 5 years to make the people self-sufficient. And the high production level of wheat is continuing. So in the case of agriculture or the immunization of children or the prevention of a disease or the eradication of a disease, those kind of things can only be done if you at least have the approval of the government, the approval of revolutionaries who control an area, and the support of the people who live there.
All right, I want to move to another area, and that's Bosnia. The United States has been, as the leader of NATO, has been hitting the Bosnian Serbs hard. At the same time, the U.S. has been leading the peace talks. Is this possible that the U.S. can be both a military actor and peacemaker in the same conflict?
Well, I think it's possible.
This interview with President Carter was conducted just before the U.S.-brokered October ceasefire agreement in Bosnia was announced.
When we went to Bosnia back in December, we worked out a very fine agreement between the Bosnian Serbs and Pali, both Dr. Karadzic and also General Mladic, because I wanted to get both the political and military leaders to sign. And the same agreement was signed by President Izetbegovic in Sarajevo. This was a comprehensive agreement, opening up an airport near Sarajevo, opening up all supply routes, a ceasing of all military activity, a withdrawal of troops from confronting one another, the return of refugees back to their own home of choice, the release of all POWs. It was a beautiful arrangement. And a key part of it was that for 4 months there would be a ceasefire, during which there would be negotiations on the basis of the 51-49% split. Unfortunately, the whole 4 months went by, and no one was willing to sit down and actually negotiate. And then, of course, you know what's happened since the end of April. Well, now I think under Ambassador Holbrooke, Assistant Secretary Richard Holbrooke, a determined effort is being made to bring all the parties to the dispute to the negotiating table. At this time, the Bosnian Serbs have said for the first time that President Milosevic in Serbia in Belgrade could speak for them. There's a limit to how much freedom he has to speak for them. But at least that's a start. And I hope that they'll at least get back to the point of reconfirming the agreement that was reached last December. That'll be a notable achievement. Military pressure, bombing and missiles on the Bosnian Serbs to remove their heavy weapons is another crisis that I think maybe could have been prevented. The Bosnian Serbs insisted that they would remove their weapons if they could be guaranteed that those defenseless positions would not be attacked after the weapons were withdrawn. But nobody was ever willing to guarantee that they wouldn't be attacked. And once they got that guarantee, then they began to remove the weapons. So, as is the case in almost every conflict, the unwillingness of negotiators or mediators to talk to all the parties to the dispute is a handicap that must be overcome before progress can be made.
Well, I have a question about something that's happened in the world that may affect that. You've met in the past with Dr. Karadzic, you mentioned the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and now we have these indictments that have been handed down by the International War Crimes Tribunal created by the UN. And I'm just wondering if those indictments in any way change the time, place, or manner that you will have contact with Dr. Karadzic or any of the other indicted people.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The answer is yes, it will affect where we can meet with them. I think it would be highly unlikely that Dr. Karadzic or General Mladic, who've been indicted, would go to a country where they might be arrested and extradited and put in prison or tried. So they'll probably stay within a very small area of the world. They go to Belgrade, they stay in Pali and so forth. I would guess they would not go, say, to Europe.
To Geneva for talks.
No, they couldn't go there. But they would send their emissaries there, the Speaker of the House of the Parliament, or in most recent cases, they've authorized President Milosevic to speak for them up to a certain point. Our communication with the Bosnian Serbs since last December has been through faxes and telephone calls and letters. And it's been very difficult since the bombing began because most of the communication system within Bosnian Serb-held territory has been destroyed by our bombs.
In Haiti, people criticized you for talking about amnesty with political leaders. What we're saying here with the indictments is that it would be improper for anyone to bring up the question of amnesty with anyone who has been indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal?
You could bring it up, and an indictment doesn't mean that you've been convicted, but it does mean that you can be arrested and held until the trial. Well, the fact is that that General Cedras in Haiti had already been given amnesty at the previous meetings that were held at Governor's Island. I mean, I wasn't authorized to give anybody amnesty. I even asked for amnesty. Every word in the agreement that we worked out with primarily President Jonassohn and with the generals in Haiti were approved in advance before we signed them by all of our leaders in the White House who were assembled there that critical afternoon, and also taken down the hall and approved by President Aristide. And that held up the process for a couple of hours in a very sensitive time. So before then acting President Jonassohn and I signed the agreement that permitted Aristide to return without violence to Haiti, every word in the agreement was approved in Washington.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with former President Jimmy Carter. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. You have to deal with some people who maybe you might not necessarily want to deal with or the government can't deal with. On the Haiti situation, you had some, you dealt with General Cedras and had relatively nice things to say about him. And I was wondering if at that point you were operating under the theory of catching more flies with honey than vinegar, or if in some way, as time has passed, has your public opinion of General Cedras changed?
Well, I think General Cedras has treated me quite well. I mean, what I mean by that is that every commitment he's given to me, he has honored. And I was acting within the very strict boundaries of the policies of the United States, the agreement that had been negotiated at Governor's Island, and two United Nations Security Council resolutions. So I went to Haiti with those texts in my hand, and we followed them precisely. And when any comment was made by me or Senator Sam Nunn or General Colin Powell about the fact that the military leaders in Haiti were acting in good faith or would honor their agreements, it was because we really believed that. And I think that the facts, events since then have shown that every aspect of the agreement that we signed has been honored.
I think what people think of when they think of your personal opinion of General Cedras is your comment about him teaching the Sunday school class.
Well, that was when I was trying to get him to agree to let me come down and negotiate a peaceful settlement. And I said, you know, sometimes I hope that you might be able to come to my Sunday school class, and I'd like for you to make some comments if you want to when you get there. Well, that was, it wasn't a very serious comment, but I don't feel in a need to retract it. As a matter of fact, the first time I met John Garang, who's a leader of the Southern Sudanese primary rebel group, I was teaching Sunday school. The subject on that Sunday was Joshua, and John Garang walked into my Sunday school classroom with four of his assistants, and they were all Dinka, you know, very black Africans, all over 6 feet and a half tall, and they dominated the Sunday school room. But every time I see John Garang since then, he mentions the fact that that he remembers that lesson and he studied that text a good bit of time. So, you know, I don't think it's inappropriate for someone who wants to bring peace or to prevent further bloodshed from trying to find some common ground and some element of confidence so that they will share with me what they really want and what they're really willing to concede. And in every negotiating process, every step of the way, every concession made by either side has to be equaled or exceeded by the benefits that come from it. And when you finally reach an agreement, both sides have to win. And then that's the principle on which we negotiate.
I want to move on to another area of the world, and that's Cuba. There's some exciting things happening at the Carter Center right now. Can you tell us anything about the goals and the process that's taking place with regard to Cuba and U.S. relations?
Well, we feel that the U.S.-Cuban relationship has been a very unpleasant and perhaps unnecessarily unpleasant event. 2 months after I became president of the United States, I lifted all travel restraints to let anybody from the United States go to Cuba. And there was a great reconciliation of families and a revisiting of homes. And I think that was the best way to bring about the realization among the Cuban people who owned the island that they could have a better life than they did have under a communist dictatorship. Also, Castro and I agreed when I was president, this is ancient history now, to open up interest sections in both Havana and Washington so that we could at least communicate with each other, even though it wasn't a full ambassadorship. I think those were still the right steps to take. Now, the Cuban-American issue has become so highly sensitive politically that nobody wants to touch it. When we meet with congressional leaders who take a very, very abusive attitude publicly, they tell me privately, we hope you will go ahead and explore some new ideas. So we don't go into this procedure with any illusions. I think that what my role should be and what it will be is to listen to as many different voices or opinions about Cuba as possible, including voices from Cuba, from the Castro government leaders, the dissidents in Cuba, the human rights heroes in Cuba, the church leaders, including the cardinal in Cuba, the different Cuban American groups, all of whom disagree with each other, and then try to form an opinion in my own mind about a consensus that might exist of what can we do to realize it, the genuine goals or ambitions or ideals of these people. And then once that happens, what to do with the opinion or the conclusion. We can share those with the leaders of our country, with the president perhaps, or the congressional leaders. We can share them with the public through interviews like this. We might take them privately down to Havana and share them with Fidel Castro, or down to Miami to share with some of the more fervent, militant Cuban-American groups. So I hope that in the process we might break the ice and make a move toward more openness, more freedom in Cuba.
That sounds good. So success looks like consensus, and then I think that consensus and we're in.
Well, the first step may not be consensus. It may be just my own concept of what might be done. But we met with a group a few minutes before you came in this room at the same table that we're sitting at now. They represented probably 8 different Cuban American groups from Miami. Their opinions are different. But I listened very carefully, and I made it clear to them that not only today, when they're here at the Carter Center, but in the future days and weeks, whenever circumstances change or they have an opinion about something, to stay in touch with me. So as we go through this process of learning and listening, then we can evolve a concept of what might be done, share that with people in the most effective way. One thing that you have to remember about the Carter Center is that we're not intimidated. You know, I'm not looking for votes. You know, none of these Cuban interests are important to us financially. We don't have anything to lose by being aggressive or open. I think public opinion might be important to us, but I think most Americans, when they are faced with the facts, for instance, might say, well, I think it's a good thing to explore new ideas with concerning Cuba. But we're very tenacious. We stick with things. We'll be very patient over a period of months or maybe even longer, and we try to be students and listeners more than we are teachers and preachers.
As president, you signed to the Senate a number of human rights treaties that sort of raised the visibility and the priority of human rights in U.S. foreign policy. What do you consider to be the most enduring legacy of that effort during your presidency?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was one particular document or one particular decision by the Congress. I think it was a bringing to the forefront of the world's consciousness the words human rights and the definition of what is a human right. And when the most powerful nation on earth and the incumbent of the White House says that a cornerstone of America's foreign policy will be the protection of human rights, there is a direct effect, and I think a permanent effect derived from that. I don't have any doubt that it had an impact in Chile, and in Brazil, and in Argentina, and in Paraguay, and in the Philippines, and in Korea. And when any leader came to the White House during that period of time, they knew that at the at or near the top of my agenda in dealing with them would be the subject of human rights. And I made sure that every ambassador of the United States in every country on earth knew that that ambassador was my personal human rights representative. And every embassy of the U.S. on earth was a haven for human rights victims. So, you know, I think that's a permanent impact of it, is what kind of impression it made of our nation's character, and also to convince people that human rights was a burning issue, perhaps the most intensely important issue to people who are suffering.
The other day I was watching a local television station back in my hometown, and I saw a Billy Graham crusade, and you were sitting there next to Billy Graham, and George Beverly Shea was singing, and it sort of got me thinking about that part of you and what you bring from your faith to these meetings. When you sit down with someone like General El-Bashir or General Cedrus or Radovan Karadzic, what from your faith do you bring to those kind of meetings and to all your efforts here?
Well, I don't want to, you know, I don't know, it's kind of a hard question for me to answer, but you know, I teach Sunday school every Sunday at home about 35 times a year. And the basic principles of peace, you know, Christ is looked upon as a Prince of Peace, sharing with others, justice, truth, compassion. I don't claim to be a champion of all these things, but those are elements of my religious faith, and also the ability to treat others as equals, even, or you might say, international pariahs, or those who are condemned for their past activities. How can they change their activities or their attitude or policies to alleviate suffering or to end human rights abuse or to bring peace to a warring society? So those are some of the things that I learned a lot from Anwar Sadat at Camp David, who pointed out to me and Begin repeatedly that we all look upon the same God as divine and as the shaper of our lives, our priorities, and our moral values. Prime Minister Begin was always a little uncomfortable with this conversation, but I was a little more at ease with it. And I think in that way, I learned to kind of seek the common ground among people who are at odds and emphasize that rather than to emphasize the differences. And once you find out what the common ground is, quite often it's very great.
President Carter, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Keith. I enjoyed it.
That's former President Jimmy Carter. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9542, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9542. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.